Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of February. Oh, what a tale is to be told the first hour of our show today. Late on the night of October 16th, 1859, John Brown launched a bold strike on a symbol of American power. He led just 18 men, seized the massive U.S. arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, freed and armed a number of slaves, vowed to liberate every bondsman in the South. Brown has been called a hero, a madman, a saint and a monster. And the book that we talk about this hour documents his rise from farm boy to revolutionary. The book is Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. And Tony Horwitz is the author and our guest this hour. Tony is also author of Confederates in the Attic, A Voyage Long and Strange, Blue Latitudes, and Baghdad Without a Map. He has worked for the Wall Street Journal and the New Yorker, has been a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard, and a visiting scholar at the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University. He is deeply interested in the Civil War. He says that his attic office is walled with books on Lincoln and Lee, slavery, and secession. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have quite a few this hour. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with this story. And here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Tony.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. Oh my gosh, what a guy this was. Wasn't he? I mean, unbelievable story. Unbelievable. We all have sort of a vague idea of what happened, but we don't really know what happened. Thanks for writing the book. It was fascinating.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Brown is certainly an American original and quite different, I think, from the way many Americans imagine him.
You talk about when you were writing Confederates in the Attic, you went on this wild road trip with a hardcore reenactor and passed through Harper's Ferry, and it just captivated your imagination.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place. It's a very spooky town. It's almost a ghost town, really, an eastern ghost town in the mountains that has about one-tenth the population it did at the time of John Brown's raid in 1859. But many of the buildings are still intact, and you can really feel his presence and the presence of that history.
Let's start with his early life because, you know, he comes from this huge family, and I'm interested in the religious beginnings of his whole life because they influence what happened when he was 59 years old, almost 60 years old, at Harper's Ferry. Talk a little bit about his father. He came from a very, very large family and rather poor family, a very religious family.
Yeah, he has really very deep American roots, descended from old Yankee farming stock in Connecticut, Puritans and Revolutionary War soldiers, and deep-dyed Calvinists, really almost a throwback to the old Puritans, a rather harsh God in their thinking, and sort of an obsession with sin, both personal and collective, and that, I think, contributes to his ferocious anti-slavery fervor, seeing slavery really as the great sin of the nation at that time.
His father had 16 children?
Yeah, and Brown ultimately outdoes him, fathering 20.
Oh, my gosh.
This was, of course, an era of large families. Sadly, though, a tremendous number of them die either in childbirth or as young children, and both Brown's mother and his first wife die young in childbirth.
Mm-hmm. And when does the idea begin to take root in his mind that slavery is wrong and he's going to do something about it?
I think he's imbued from an early age, largely through his father, who's an early abolitionist, with a hatred of slavery. But it's not really until his 30s that he begins showing signs of a really militant opposition. This is really the era, the 1830s, when abolitionism is emerging as an organized movement, and the South is becoming ever brasher in its defense of slavery. And Brown quietly begins plotting his own really violent overthrow of the institution.
Does he do things like harbor slaves? Does he take that kind of action as a young man?
Yes. There's evidence he assisted fugitive slaves, was part of the Underground Railroad network. He also wrote about wanting to take a black child into his home and to start a school for black children. But he had a large family and a struggling business career, and it really wasn't until middle age that he began sort of actively scheming his great plan that comes to fruition in the 1850s.
Who does he identify most with in the Bible? Who does he think he is?
Well, it's fascinating. He really cycles through a number of Old Testament figures who he identifies with. Joshua, Gideon blowing his trumpet and defeating the wicked Midianites with a small band. I think Gideon is essential to him. Later on in his life, Moses leading slaves to the promised land. And ultimately, Samson, pulling down the pillars of slavery and dying in its ruins.
Mm-hmm. In addition to, at an early age, when I believe you write, he saw a slave boy beaten with iron shovels. He also displayed, you talk about, an unusual tolerance toward the native inhabitants in Ohio.
Yeah, at a young age, he moves with his family to northern Ohio, which in the early 1800s was really the frontier. And both his father and John Brown display a really striking tolerance for Native Americans at a time when whites and Indians were really at loggerheads and often fighting with each other. So there was a deep strain of a kind of liberation, thinking about liberty and equality for all in this family.
And yet he exhibited acts of, maybe they were common then, but cruelty really with his children, arrogance, self-certitude, a domineering manner.
Yeah, he was a difficult man as well, very much the patriarch. Again, I think saw himself as a sort of biblical patriarch and shepherd leading this large brood. And even though corporal punishment was common in that day, I think Brown dispensed the rod with special vigor. He really believed in rooting out sin in himself and others. So he certainly didn't spare his children the rod.
Tell me about other events that were going on during his lifetime that he may have been influenced by. I'm thinking about Nat Turner. I'm thinking about abolitionists who were outspoken. Who did he listen to? Who did he maybe meet with? And what events inspired him?
Yeah, he's very much a product of his time. His radicalism doesn't just spring out of nowhere. He's 30 or 31 when Nat Turner launches his slave insurrection in Virginia, the largest slave rebellion in American history. Nat Turner and his followers slaughter about 60 whites before they're captured and killed. William Lloyd Garrison emerges in the 1830s as really the leader of organized abolitionism, and I think he has a strong influence on Brown, even though they ultimately part ways because Garrison is a profound pacifist. And I think he's also influenced by Southerners, Southern leaders like John Calhoun, who in this period are saying that slavery is not a wrong, it's a right. They're defending it as morally good, uplifting to Africans and freeing to whites, frees whites of drudgery and class conflict. This is very much in the news as well in the 1830s.
Mm-hmm. And what about his father, Tony? Was his father a pacifist?
Yeah, his father was also a pacifist. Most abolitionists in this period were pacifists. They believed that violence, even in the cause of freedom, really only recapitulated the sins of slaveholders, that this institution should be met with education, with moral suasion, with Christian uplift. Brown derided this as what he called milk and water abolitionism. He thought slavery was a state of war and must be met in kind. And that really set him apart from most abolitionists of his era.
And did people react to that with some dismay, or did he find a number of people who said, go to it?
Yeah, I would say the organized abolitionism, Garrison and his followers, were initially quite dismayed by Brown's acts. Brown really emerges as a militant abolitionist in the 1850s in Kansas and gains a quick notoriety, and pacifists are not always in agreement with his tactics. On the other hand, they come to admire his conviction and ultimately defend him.
And let's talk a little bit about Kansas. His sons had preceded him in Kansas, and he went to Kansas. They urged him to go there. Well, this was a state that was, it was battling over what the territory's future would be. It's going to be slave. Is it going to be a free state, which must have been a place where he wanted to be to engage in that debate. What happened, what events happened that he took place in, that he took part in that state regarding slavery?
Yeah, Kansas in the mid-1850s is really the front line in the conflict over whether slavery is going to extend to new Western territories. And this is really, more than anything, what brings on the Civil War. And he arrives there at a moment when really the South has the upper hand. Pro-slavery settlers are intimidating and sometimes killing Northerners who want Kansas to be a free state. And Brown takes up arms. He and his sons and others, they fight in Lawrence, Kansas, or they march to Lawrence, Kansas, which is under siege by pro-slavery forces. And then in a really shocking act in 1856, they drag five pro-slavery settlers from their beds in the middle of the night and slaughter them with broadswords. Brown then takes to the open field and fights a number of battles against much larger pro-slavery forces, and it's really at this time that the territory becomes known as Bleeding Kansas, and Brown is right there in the middle of it.
And do people in the country know about Brown?
Yeah, it's really at this time, in the summer of 1856, that he first gains a name in Eastern anti-slavery papers. His exploits are touted. Journalists follow him and write about him as this great anti-slavery crusader, this sort of latter-day Cromwell. He's this sort of Puritan warrior. And really at that time, he becomes quite well-known and gains a large following among abolitionists.
Mm-hmm. And is there a lot of debate about his tactics? Are some people appalled, and do they write about how appalled they may be by some of his actions?
I think people at this time are so embittered and enraged and divided between the slavery and pro-slavery camp. Certainly the pro-slavery camp, the newspapers there, paint him as a, you know, complete monster. In the North, I think they covered up some of his most violent acts in the newspapers and focused more on his character and his words in ferociously opposing slavery at a time when really the South was the bully on the national scene. He was the rare Northerner in this period who was punching back hard, and I think that really galvanized Northern opinion.
You talk about his words. Did he write about all of this?
Yeah, he wrote extensively, many letters. He also wrote letters to newspapers back east to keep them apprised of his doings. He was quite canny in terms of using the media. He also had followers and family members who wrote letters. So his activities are really quite well documented.
Were there a lot of people when he was doing these Kansas activities, were there people who wrote to him or tried to contact him and say, we really want to join you, Tony?
They found him more in Kansas. I haven't found a lot of letters, at least from this period, of people approaching him, but certainly like-minded, mostly young men in Kansas, made their way to Brown so that, and he also recruited people, so that really he has a band, hard to put an exact number on it. This is really kind of a guerrilla war situation. But, you know, there are perhaps 50 men who are fighting with him and many others who are allied in their own guerrilla band.
When does he get the idea of the attack in Harper's Ferry, and how carefully does he plan it?
Yeah, it's impossible to pinpoint exactly when he gets this idea. I think it was germinating for decades, perhaps as early as the 1830s. Certainly by the 1840s, he tells Frederick Douglass, the famous black abolitionist, about a plan for going down through the mountains into Virginia to launch lightning raids against slavery. And it's in the late 1850s, after his Kansas exploits, that he first mentions Harper's Ferry specifically as a target. It's a federal armory, one of only two in the whole country, 100,000 guns, in the largest slave state in the country, and he really begins to focus in on that beginning in about 1857.
Hmm. And what kind of contact did he have with Frederick Douglass? Were they friends?
Yeah, he has a very interesting and complicated relationship with Frederick Douglass, and it's another aspect in which Brown was really a very radical figure, even among abolitionists. While abolitionists obviously wanted to free slaves and express their love for enslaved Americans, they could also be very condescending towards blacks. Sort of, you know, leave it to us whites to do the job. They felt blacks were inferior and too docile to fight for their own freedom. Brown is not like that at all. He really regards blacks as equals and feel that whites and blacks must fight alongside each other. And he wants Douglass to be there with him and urges Douglass to come with him. And he stays for weeks at a time at Douglass's home in upstate New York. And the men meet many times and really become friends.
Mm-hmm. And what is Douglass? Did Douglass write about Brown?
Yeah, Douglass writes extensively about Brown. He's one of our best sources. He's also, in my view, one of the great orators in American history. His speeches in which he talks about Brown are really, I would say, up there with Lincoln's speeches and others as the best in our history. He's very drawn to Brown's conviction, but he's not very confident in Brown's abilities as a military commander, and doesn't think his plan is going to work, and ultimately decides not to join Brown.
And he had valid reasons for not being very confident in his military ability.
Yeah, Brown was really a dreamer. He was one of these people who always thought big, you know, always had these grand plans, not only as an abolitionist, also as a businessman, and ultimately went bankrupt as a result. And I think Douglass saw that quality in him, that he was a wishful thinker, and that Brown really thought that with this small guerrilla band, he could seize this federal armory and begin a war of liberation that would free every slave in the South. And I think Douglass, as a former and escaped slave himself, had a clearer sense than Brown of what he was up against and how unlikely it was that this plan was going to succeed.
And yet, it may have been the spark that started the Civil War?
I believe it was. There's no one spark, but I think it certainly hastened the Civil War. Essentially, all through the 1850s, you have this tension building in the country, almost this kindling piling up around the nation. And at Harper's Ferry, Brown really puts a match to it. And the jolt this gives to the nation, I think, after that, there's really no going back from Civil War.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour tells the fascinating story of John Brown in his new book, Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. Tony Horwitz is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open if you'd like to grab one. Or you can use the email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Reza Aslan, author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. And he talks about the Arab Spring entering a new year. What are we likely to see in this new year? All right, let's go to phone calls for our guest, Tony Horwitz, and we start with Fred in La Crosse. Hi, Fred.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Greetings from Company B, 2nd Wisconsin Regiment reenactors.
Great.
I got a comment and a question. Interestingly, one of the soldiers from La Crosse, one of several staunch abolitionists, and anyway, this fellow, U.P. Olin, he was killed at Antietam, but interestingly, his great-great nephew, and unless he's moved on or retired, is the architectural historian at Harper's Ferry. Oh. Just thought you might find that interesting. Yeah. But my question is, I read a reference somewhere that Lucius Fairchild, who became colonel of the 2nd Wisconsin and lost an arm at Gettysburg, prior to the Civil War, Lucius and his family, I believe, had dealings with the John Brown, business relationship with John Brown. And I'm wondering if in your research, if you've come across that Wisconsin connection.
Oh, gosh, I'd have to go back through all my notes. Brown's business affairs were incredibly tangled. He was a wool merchant, a cattle breeder, a property speculator. He goes bankrupt. He fails again later in his career. So he leaves this sort of 30-year paper trail of financial disaster, mostly. And it's possible the Fairchilds are in there somewhere. I have to admit the name does not ring a bell, nor does any business dealing in Wisconsin. He was principally in northern Ohio and later in Massachusetts and upstate New York. I'll add to your comment that Antietam actually comes into my story because Harper's Ferry, as you know, is only 10 miles from Antietam.
Right.
It's really the second act of the story of emancipation. Brown helped spark the Civil War, and it's as a result of Antietam that that Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation. So the two stories really are quite connected.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call, Fred. Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
First of all, before I ask my question, I would just like to compliment your author. I thoroughly enjoyed Confederates in the Attic. It was one of the most memorable books I've ever read, and if this one's anything like it, I'm looking forward to it greatly.
Thank you.
What I'd like to ask you about is, with everything about the Civil War being, forefront now on the anniversary, I recently came across something that, if I recall correctly, said that one of the great admirers, Brown's great admirers, was John Wilkes Booth. And first of all, I'd like to know, is this true? And if it is, can you tell us more about that? What if this isn't one of history's oddest couples? I don't know what is.
He saw his hanging, didn't he?
Yeah. This is one of the things I love about the Harper's Ferry story is the cast of characters on the southern side. It's almost a dress rehearsal for the Confederacy. You have Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart leading U.S. Marines against Brown in a counterattack. Stonewall Jackson appears later, and then John Wilkes Booth, who, spoiler alert here, Brown is captured and hanged, and John Wilkes Booth is one of the soldiers guarding his gallows, and later writes about him. He didn't exactly admire him. It was a mix of horror and admiration. He hated everything Brown stood for as an abolitionist. But he admired his a willingness to take an act as an individual that changed the course of history. And so I speculate that helped inspire his own act in assassinating Lincoln. These two acts of individual violence are really the bookends to the Civil War era, one in 1859, the other in 1865.
Fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott, so much for the call. Please tell us the story of how you gather 18 men to go with you to Harper's Ferry on what many must have thought was going to be a suicide mission.
Mm-hmm. It was actually really the favorite part of the story for me. Brown is a fascinating figure, but we know something about him, but his followers have really been neglected, and they're a very colorful group of individuals, a cross-section of northern society at the time. They're farmers, factory workers, free blacks, fugitive slaves. It's really a kind of interesting motley crew, and they share Brown's passionate conviction that slavery must be overthrown by force, but they're otherwise quite unlike Brown. They're young men. They don't share his religious beliefs. They act up. They spend a lot of time courting women. So it's a wonderful kind of sweaty drama of Brown trying to hold together this unlikely band as they hide out in the summer before the raid in a hideout in the mountains of Maryland. And it almost falls apart. It's really the dynamics of any conspiracy, I think, come out in this story.
And how many of his sons go on this?
He fights with five of his sons in Kansas earlier on, one of whom's killed several of whom are wounded. Harper's Ferry, he has three of his sons with him, two of whom are killed in the raid. One escapes. And he has a daughter, Annie, a teenager, who comes down and spends the summer in this hideout in the mountains, acting as a lookout and camouflage for this guerrilla band. So it's really a very much a family affair.
What does his wife think of all of this?
Well, unfortunately, this is now his second wife. His first one dies decades earlier in childbirth. His second wife, Mary, I think really has a very hard life, 13 children, 9 of whom die young. Endures a really great poverty. Brown is away for years at a time on these abolitionist exploits. While she shares her husband's convictions about slavery, she expresses unhappiness in her letters about his constant recruiting of family members, and I think helps to hold some of them back. But she's clearly not thrilled that her whole family is putting itself at risk for her husband's rather grandiose scheme.
I would imagine she was more than a little bit upset, Tony.
Yeah, but yeah. She never publicly says so. And once he's arrested, she stands right by him and goes down and visits him the night before his hanging and really cherishes his memory. So I think the family was fully devoted to his cause without always agreeing with Brown's tactics.
Paul in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. This morning, your program, I find very, very interesting. I had a question and a comment first and a question. This morning on the news, it announced that a country club in the South had decided to accept women, and they had previously decided to accept blacks and Jews and Asians. And I would be very interesting to know, in light of the research that this gentleman has done, to what extent he thinks those prejudices still exist in the South. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, good question, and I wish I could, you know, answer that. I think it's very hard to generalize, and while I lived in Virginia for many years and reported from the South, I now live in Massachusetts, so I'm not sure I'm the best authority. I guess my response would be I think things are definitely improving, slower than they should, but more importantly, I wouldn't stick this all on the South. I think we have this habit of seeing the South as somehow, I don't know, our evil twin or something, and we project what are really national problems onto the South. So we always notice when these sorts of stories arise in Alabama or Mississippi and are less likely to comment on eruptions of prejudice and racism when they occur in Wisconsin or Massachusetts. So I think this is really a national issue, but I would say things are you know, slowly improving in most regards.
And yet you do write, this was a piece you wrote for the New York Times in 2010, those Southern leaders, you write, in the 1860s called slavery the cornerstone of their cause, some of their successors are intent on scrubbing that legacy from memory. Earlier this year in Virginia, Governor McDonald proclaimed April to be Confederate History Month without mentioning slavery.
Yeah, well, that's, I guess, perhaps a different issue is in terms of historical memory. And I find it quite shocking that actually when they do surveys now of, you know, what was the cause or the heart of the Civil War, I think roughly half, if not more, of Americans say states' rights.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's actually more than what was the case 20, 30 years ago. And young people particularly are shifting to that view. So I think in terms of historical memory, I'm not at all convinced things are going in the right direction. I think the country is still unwilling to really grapple with how fundamental slavery was, not just in the South. This, again, was a national issue. It was interesting for me to do the research on this book, how much this was really a slave nation before the Civil War. Southerners controlled the White House, the Supreme Court, and most of Congress for almost the entire era between the nation's founding and the Civil War. So this was really a national issue in which Northerners were complicit in terms of business and politics. And I think we're still, you know, not fully prepared to face that.
Well, why in the world are more people shifting to the opinion that it was a states' rights issue?
Well, I think states' rights generally and a sort of libertarian philosophy has, you know, been on the rise in recent decades. I think it's fair to say that politically the nation has shifted to the right, and I think perhaps that's part of it. I don't know. I don't think it's really the way it's being taught in schools, judging from, you know, my son's textbooks and others I've seen. I think teachers are doing their best. So that's an interesting question. But I think there's this sort of reemergent romanticization of the Confederate cause. And really, it was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, was to better understand really why this war came about in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's obviously a complicated story, but slavery is right there at the core, in Southerners' own words, all through this John Brown crisis and what follows.
Right. Pete in Madison, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, Pete, how are you?
Wonderful.
Good.
This is a fascinating topic. I actually have an indirect connection to the story of John Brown through some other history that I've explored. But there's a piece that's always been missing for me. I know that, you know, he is, as an adult, he's a kind of a failed businessman. He's a frontier farmer. He ends up with some land in the late 1840s in the Adirondacks that Gerrit Smith gave to him to allow him to help free blacks to farm, and the question is it these experiences in his life that made him so powerfully a zealot against slavery and for the abolition of it, or was it something in his youth? Where does he get this drive that leads ultimately to Harper's Ferry?
Right, it's a very good question, and I don't unfortunately think there's, you know, one clear answer. He writes in an autobiographical letter late in his life that he saw a slave boy beaten with a shovel when he was 12, and that this sort of, you know, was the beginning of his war on slavery. But I really think it goes to his father and to his family's beliefs and to the times in which he lived when this issue is coming to a head. And I think it's also temperamental. He's the sort of person who nothing galvanizes him more than bullying that goes unanswered. He can't stand the sort of cravenness in the face of what he regards as evil. He's someone who always wants to punch back. And I think he's just enraged by really the South's bullying in this period, this whole cotton is king and no one dare defy it. And he wants to stand up to that in a way that others aren't. So I think that contributes to his actions as well.
Mm. How much, getting back to slavery, how much is slavery on trial nationally as a result of the actions and his trial? Are people debating this issue from the very depths of their hearts?
Yeah, well, this is really when Brown begins to ascend into legend. The irony of this story is that this man who has disdain for words and says, you know, he's all about action, fails in his actions at Harper's Ferry. In military terms, it's a debacle. But then he triumphs through the power of his words in prison and in court, where, as you say, he puts slavery on trial. He really turns the case around and says it's you who are guilty, Southerners, for violating the Golden Rule and the Declaration of Independence. And really, by implication, it's you, Northerners, who are guilty as well for standing by and doing nothing. To have done nothing would have been a greater crime, he says of himself. So, and he says it incredibly eloquently. And this is really what begins to shift Northern opinion and make him a hero and a martyr in the North.
He's really a very important figure, isn't he, Tilly?
Extremely so. And, you know, he's had a very interesting legacy as well. Obviously, he inspires, you know, the song John Brown's Body in the Civil War that then becomes the battle hymn of the Republic. Thoreau and Emerson and many others write about him at great length. And he becomes in later years an icon for a really curious range of activists, from anarchists in the 19th century to Black Panthers in the 1960s, to weathermen up in your neck of the woods in the early 1970s, and then in recent decades to anti-abortion bombers and people like Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah,
he sets a complicated and somewhat troubling example.
Pete, thanks for your call. Gary and Ripon, hi.
Hi. I believe I heard Tony on National Public Radio a short while ago, and they posed the question, is John Brown a hero or a terrorist? And it seems to me the answer is that he's both, and that everything that's been said about him is true. He's a very complicated figure, and I don't think there are any such thing as totally pure motives in life.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I think part of the problem with the way we remember Brown, and even the way he's been treated in biographies, is one or the other. Everyone's always trying to fit him into a box. He's a monster and a terrorist, or he's a hero or a martyr. And as you say, I think he has elements of both. He raises really prickly, uncomfortable questions. We can admire his conviction and see that he was on the right side of history, and willing to take on the great moral issue of his day, while also saying, well, gee, killing people, and in some cases innocent people, may not have been the way to go. So I think, he really, you can't fit him into any easy, pigeonhole. And that's why I find him so fascinating.
What was the aftermath of Harper's Ferry? How many people did die, Tony?
About 25 total, and most of those are Brown's men. Most of them die or are hanged as a result of the raid. Several slaves lose their lives. And about 5 white Virginians are killed in the fighting. And that's obviously a small toll compared, what's to follow in the Civil War. But at the time, this was a very dramatic incident. This was a nation that really didn't have a political violence at that time. There had been no assassinations to that point. The Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry was virtually unguarded. So this really was a jolt to the nation, a little bit like 9/11 was for us. It kind of came out of the blue, this surprise strike on a symbol of American power just 60 miles from the nation's capital. And the news coverage, it's front page news around the country for weeks.
Mm. I believe that you said somewhere that the raid also helped to elect Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, I really believe Lincoln might well not have become president without John Brown. It's a little complicated, but briefly, there's a presidential campaign in progress at the time of the raid, and Lincoln at that point is really a second-tier candidate in the Republican field, a little known outside of Illinois. But the raid sort of discredits his competitors, who are viewed as a little too militant, perhaps a little too close to the John Brown school. And he deftly really uses Brown as a foil, criticizes him, and positions himself as really the safely moderate choice in the Republican field. And this helps him get the nomination. And it also helps him get elected, because John Brown's raid also drives a wedge through the other party, the Democratic Party, between its southern and northern wings. So Lincoln ultimately wins the election in the fall with less than 40% of the vote. It's a very divided field, in part because of John Brown's raid.
Tony Horowitz, our guest this hour, his book, fascinating, you can imagine from hearing him talk about all of it, is Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Gary, thanks for your call. The email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we talk about the Arab Spring, which has entered a new year with revolutions gathering momentum in Syria, Bahrain, and Yemen. Our guest is Reza Aslan, author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Back to phone calls for our guest, Tony Horwitz, author of Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War, Bill in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, earlier you were talking about reasons that the American public might be so convinced that the Civil War is about states' rights instead of slavery as the primary reason. And I think that's normal to think that because we associate the states' rights argument with the Southern excuse for the Northern war of aggression that they used in the 1950s and so forth. But, you know, in the 1980s, African-American leadership, some African-American leadership at least, was also citing state rights, and they diminished slavery as a cause. And I think it, you know, my speculation is it may have been to undermine some of the self-righteous high ground, moral high ground of Northerners, but, you know, to bring home the issue that, you know, there's also a Northern problem, because that was coinciding with the argument that the North was also complicit with slavery.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, and I think you're right. I certainly found that while reporting Confederates in the Attic back in the 1990s. There's tremendous cynicism in the African-American community about Lincoln and about the general sort of self-serving view that some Northerners have, that this was all a righteous war to end slavery. And I think they're right. Lincoln himself, of course, said early in the war that he was not fighting to end slavery. He was fighting to preserve the Union. And so it's a complicated question in terms of what the Union was fighting for. But I think there's no question when you go into the Southern letters and documents, et cetera, that they know what they're fighting for. All you have to do is read the statements justifying their secession. Many of them mention John Brown's raid, and they say quite explicitly things like slavery is the greatest interest in the world, and we must either fight to defend it or bow to the abolitionists. So I think, you know, it's right there in the historical record, and we've lost a lot of that in the memory.
At the risk of being too simple about it, no slavery, no war.
Yeah, I mean that's what I would say, and that doesn't mean that every Union soldier who is every Wisconsin boy who is going into battle is fighting to end slavery, or
right,
that every Alabama farm boy is fighting to defend it. That's a different question, really, of why people fought. But I think certainly no slavery, no war.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Robert in Stevens Point. Hi.
Yes. I'd like to know whether you think that John Brown's guerrilla wars in Kansas were instrumental in Kansas entering the Union as a free state, or whether his efforts were negligible. And there's one other question occurred to me while I was waiting. Would you mind mentioning something about Harriet Tubman's alleged plan to participate in a raid at Harper's Ferry that summer of 1859, but she couldn't because she had she fell ill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first on Harriet Tubman, like Frederick Douglass, Brown is seeking the support of Harriet Tubman and meets with her and hopes that she's going to help him recruit blacks, particularly former slaves in Canada, to join him, and also give him valuable help in that sort of borderland between the North and the South that she was so familiar with. But then she kind of goes AWOL in the summer of 1859, and we really have very little to go on except that she's in New Bedford and apparently ill. So she, again, after the fact, is a great defender of Brown, but it's unclear whether, like Douglass, she began to have doubts, or whether she just simply couldn't be there. On your other question, I think Brown was a very important figure in Kansas, but there were many other free state fighters. He got a lot of publicity, but I wouldn't say it was all because of him. There were many others, and it was really a rare victory for the free state side in the period leading up to the war that Kansas does enter the Union, not until 1861, but as a free state.
Thank you, Robert, for the call. Mike in Milwaukee, hi.
Kathleen, thank you so much for this program. I really admire Brown. He was I'll just let you know, I was reading a book by David Reynolds, John Brown Abolitionist, and I'm going to get this guy's book as well. You know, we only read a paragraph in our history books about this guy, and they show the picture with his hair wild and like he was a crazy guy, but the guy was absolutely brilliant. Who were his contemporaries that supported him? It was Garrison, that was a publisher of a newspaper, I think. And then, was it Walt Whitman?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the roster of figures who support him is quite astonishing. His core group of supporters is called the Secret Six. This is this covert group that's funneling him money and guns. These are very prominent figures. Two of them, Gerrit Smith and a man named Stearns, are two of the richest men of their day. Four of them are Harvard men, reformers, transcendentalists. He dines with Emerson and Thoreau and Concord, who are great admirers. Whitman later writes about him. So he really captures the imagination of New Englanders in particular, who are kind of intoxicated by this rough-hewn frontier warrior who's willing to fight and die for what he believes in. I'll just say, since you mentioned David Reynolds' book, it's an excellent biography of Brown. Mine is a little different in that I talk more about the other characters, perhaps, and Harper's Ferry and the raid itself. It's more a biography of an event, perhaps. Anyway, be curious what you think.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. You will enjoy this book. He makes an interesting point that we know vaguely who Brown is through American history, through the classes, but I think that he's right, that it's a paragraph or maybe it's a page about John Brown for somebody, as we've been learning this hour, who was such an instrumental figure in sparking a civil war. Why is he reduced to a paragraph?
Right. Well, we've sort of walked around the edges of this, but he makes us uncomfortable, and so it's easier to, as the previous caller said, he's often depicted as this sort of wild-eyed, wild-haired fanatic. In fact, he didn't have that famous scary beard of his until the last year of his life, when he was trying to disguise his identity. For most of his life, he's this clean-shaven businessman who wears dark suits and takes business trips to Europe. He's actually a very American on the make in the first half of the 19th century, but it's easier to sort of dismiss him, to say he was this crazy man and lone gunman like others in our history, rather than to accept that he's very American, a Bible in one hand and a gun in the other. These are enduring strains in our character, and I think because he makes us uncomfortable, and also because Harper's Ferry is overshadowed so quickly by what happens in the Civil War. As I said earlier, 25 people die. Well, at Antietam, there are 23,000 casualties in one day. So I think he also, the wave of the Civil War, washes over. It makes Harper's Ferry seem like a rather minor street fight. Really.
Did he make you uncomfortable?
Absolutely. I kept kind of swinging, the pendulum swings one way and then the other. And I was trying to be as really impartial as I could, to come to this topic freshly and really not pass judgment on him. Let the reader decide how they feel, and just put the story out there in as compelling a way as I could. So absolutely, sometimes I'd be kind of enraged at this man, particularly at times his treatment of his family. And other times felt very stirred by him. I mean, after I'm in my 50s now, here's a man who in his 50s has really been a failure his whole life, and still is able to kind of scrape himself off the floor and change history, and take on the great moral issue of his day. That's in a way a rather inspiring American story.
Art in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I just want to point out, maybe you can help on this, there's been some reluctance to recognize that someone such as John Brown could be white and put his life on the line to fight slavery. Two examples. Herb Apthecker used to mention that when he lectured in high schools to black students, they were amazed that a white person would do this. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I used to run a bookstore in the 60s and 70s. We had a good section on black history, etc. there was one paperback biography on John Brown, probably a Harper Torchback or something, and they on the cover had his face colored dark brown.
Oh, interesting. We have about 15 seconds, Tony.
Yeah, I'll just say that's accurate. Many people still think he's black, and he's always been an icon in the African-American community. Many great black painters and also poets like Langston Hughes have written about him. So he's you're right. He confuses Americans somewhat.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. And there was so much interest in this. We were just flooded with phone calls. Thank you.
Glad to hear it. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, our pleasure, Tony. Tony Horwitz, the book is Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. Some of you from your calls are familiar with one, at least, of his other books, Confederates in the Attic, and he's written a number of other books as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, and then we'll be talking about the Arab Spring, year two, so please join us for that, what's sure to be a great conversation with a wonderful guest. So stay with us.